that once I have been, quote, there, and for there, so I don't sound like some, like too much, let me reference Frank Barron's remarks yesterday, because he certainly is straight, a psychologist. And he listed a number of criteria for consciousness. He did it exquisitely, so I'd like to borrow his list. The first one he suggested was range of effective attention. That is the experience of simultaneously being conscious of many levels of awareness, so that I can understand that at the same time I am involved in what you will excuse my language is the game of lecturing, right? I can also, I think, stand aside and see myself involved in the game of lecturing. And I also can jump to some other levels of consciousness in which I can see relationships between us other than the social role which we are presently involved in, that is, of lecturer and audience. And at times I even realize that we are all slowed down light. Now, the second point Frank makes is the realization of depths and heights for which no words exist. And I want to read to you a very brief example of that. This is in a book called Black Elk Speaks. It's the life story of a holy man of the Ogallala Sioux. And it's an extraordinary book, and it describes this Black Elk's first mystic visionary experience, which sounds very much like hundreds of psychedelic reports I have back in the files. This is the one he had when he was 9 years old. And he said, "And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing in a sacred manner the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes, as they must live together like one being. And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and as starlight. And in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. And I saw that it was holy. I am sure now that I was then too young to understand it all and that I only felt it. It was the pictures I remembered and the words that went with them, for nothing I have ever seen with my eyes was so clear and bright as what my vision showed me. And no words that I have ever heard with my ears were like the words I heard. I did not have to remember these things. They have remembered themselves all these years. It was as I grew older that the meanings came clearer and clearer out of the pictures and the words. And even now I know that more was shown to me than I can tell." And I think for most of us that describes a component of our own experiences. The third thing Frank mentions is sensitivity of breadth of consciousness of others. Now here I think that there is an absolutely fascinating research area concerning empathy and ESP. When I was running a session, guiding a session, at one point a fellow said to me, now let me explain what I was doing. I was lying there listening to the music and I was being with him. Now this is in silence. So that primarily what happened was I suddenly got a picture of the inside of his head. And it looked like caves, and there were waterfalls, and it was dark and mysterious and jungly. And I was in the midst of this, and suddenly he turned to me and he said, "Are you inside my head?" Now, I put that away because those are the kind of things you don't like to think about. And about a week later, I was guiding a session for a political science professor at Harvard. And this time, I got another visual image, and I was in a French cathedral, very stately, kind of cold, formal. And while I was in the walking with my footsteps echoing down the halls of this cathedral, he turned to me and he said, "I have the strangest feeling that you're inside my head." That's the way chance works. At one point, I had a session with a fellow. We took 700 micrograms in the middle of the day, sitting in two upright chairs facing one another in an empty room. He had created the setting. I had not. Now, this was a little much for me, and I found myself glued against the back of the chair while he danced about me, playing the horn, whispering in my ear, showing me beautiful jewels, putting on strange hats. And finally, I went to the floor thinking to myself, if there only wasn't so much light. At which point he walked over and he pulled down the shades. So I thought about that, and I feel, well, that's silly. You know, that's just chance. But what I need is about 10 minutes rest. I thought that, and he said, oh, take 20 or 30. And then he walked over to me, and he looked down at me, and he laughed. Now, it strikes me that if you read the many reports of ESP experiences that are available, that most of the experiences involve two minds that were working very much in parallel. Mother and child, husband and wife, two intimate friends. And that when you use an experimenter and a subject who hardly know each other at all, you often don't get much better than chance. Although J.B. Rhine has worked hard to show some slight statistical gain. And it seems obvious to me that a very real set of researchers can and should be done, in which one creates an opportunity for two people to get, if you will, their mind in phase with one another through the use of psychedelics. Finally, the fourth category that Frank mentions is ability to observe and yet not observe the subject-object distinction. That is to experience the feeling we are all one at the same time as maintaining the distinctions that exist among us. Now, it is very interesting that the LSD experience comes at a time when Marshall McLuhan, for example, points out that we are in the electric age, when we can extend our central nervous system through technological means to the point where the world becomes like a big village because everything is instantaneous. We know everything that's going on everywhere in the village. And Buckminster Fuller tells us that it's gotten to the point now where if we all collaborated, there could be enough for everybody. And then we have these psychedelic experiences in which we experience unity and we seek collaborative relationships. And as I experience a unity in the universe, in the world, let's say, I find it very desirable to make it all subject. And I also understand that almost any learning can occur almost instantaneously if one is able to get rid of the subject-object distinction between that which one learns and that which is learned. And you have all had that experience of one trial learning under conditions where you were really, quote, turned on to the thing you were learning. Okay, now I'm going to stop shortly, but what I asked myself was, well, okay, if this experience is so great, how could I stay high all the time? I could put it in a little more a serious vein, say, how could I stay in a state of ecstasis, that is, a fluid cognitive state? How could I be fully conscious all the time? Well, it's very tempting to figure if you just keep using enough LSD, it'll do it. So we got five of us together and we went into a house and we decided to stay high forever. Now, in order to do this, we had to take 400 micrograms every 4 hours or 2,000 micrograms a day. And we carry this experiment out roughly in more or less formal fashion, but continuing on the dosage, for 3 weeks. Now, it's very interesting about that experiment, first of all, that I'm here to tell about it. And just a few of the interesting aspects of it. First of all, it was apparent to me that you do not stay at the highest state of consciousness for 3 weeks. You do not stay with the clear white light. You do not stay where all is one in a completely homogeneous field. You stay much more at what you'd call second bardo. You go way out and then you come back to some middle level, but you definitely stay with a heightened sense of awareness. And then I found an interesting thing about sleep patterns, because after a while, you don't go to sleep and you don't go to sleep, and then you go into neutral. And you're there, and yet you're completely at rest. And 3 weeks later, when I emerged, I was just as physically healthy as when I went in, rested. And I realized, we broke that experiment up, it fell apart, because we had not made realistic arrangements for dealing with the interface between that experiment and the rest of the world. Because during that experiment, during the initial stages of the experiment, it wasn't possible to carry on a set of external game commitments or external social contracts. And it would seem to me a very reasonable research to carry that such an experiment out under conditions where you provide a supportive environment to see what indeed will happen. There was change. But the interesting thing was, when we stopped taking the LSD, we all came down. Well, in the past few years, knowing that the government might get some controls on, and also in attempt to find other ways that one could build into one's life, I've been involved with a macrobiotic diet at some length, with karate at some length, a student of Gurdjieff, of Meher Baba, been involved in dance groups, have been involved in meditation and breathing exercises. Once I had had one psychedelic experience, all these other things worked. Because once you have been one time outside of yourself, and you know where that place is, it's the easiest thing in the world to get back there. And then I started to understand that it was going to be the way in which we created our environment or setting that was going to determine whether we could stay fully conscious all of the time. Because obviously, LSD wasn't going to do it. As I understood LSD now, all it did was show you the possibility or remind you of the possibility, but you still had to do the things in your everyday life to make it all work. See, it's a very interesting thing that the Easterner spends 10, 12 years turning off all of his attachments, getting free of all of his commitments, going to the mountaintop, meditating, eating nettle soup, living through snow and sleet and rain, and finally he experiences enlightenment, maybe, if he's 1 in 10. 1 in 10 after 12 years commitment. Very poor probabilities. But once he's made it, then he can probably retain that heightened sense of integrity with the whole universe because he doesn't have any environment that's going to bring him down. He doesn't go back into a network of habits that are going to catch him back up again. The Westerner doesn't have time. He's not going to go sit in the mountaintop for 12 years in a 1 in 10 chance, right? But there is a help for him because along come psychedelics mysteriously, just as he's about to blow himself to oblivion. And here now with DMT, we can assure a businessman that during his lunch hour, he can have a totally... But probably at 2 p.m. he'll be just as hung up as he was at 10, with a memory in addition, the memory of what that openness was like. So it may turn out, you see, that all the drug did was to take we cynical Westerners and give us hope. By showing us the possibility and starting us, as I was started, on a journey, which is irrevocable. And that the journey will end up taking just as long as it would have had we done it in the East on faith, without knowing what the end point was like. But we didn't have enough faith to do it. Now, we have been through a series of... many social community experiments trying to create an environment that would allow you to maintain full consciousness. And all of them have failed, and all of them have taught us a great deal. And I think the word failure is the wrong word. They've all ended. They've ended because they were completed, because we saw the fallacy or the limit of the situation, or it was time to change into another institution. But out of it all, I have come up with some basic rules, I feel, that are reasonable for entering into a community game designed to provide an environment for you to have maximum consciousness. First thing involves the numbers. While I think that the acid tests are great for a fleeting moment for many people, large groups provide many nooks and crannies for egos to hide in. At the other end of that continuum, the number one is a very risky number to work with, Because it appears very easy for you to get caught in your own defenses and be unable, if you will, to up-level them or see through them or get beyond them. Gurdjieff, the Russian philosopher, puts it very well. He says, you don't realize your predicament. You're all in prison. Prisons of your mind, of your learned mind. Were you to escape, the first thing you must realize is that you're in prison. After all, if you think you're free, you can't escape from prison. Second thing is you can't escape alone. You need the help of others. And then finally, he points out that you need maps and guides because, after all, you've been in prison ever since you can remember. You don't even know which way is out. So that if we say, well, one isn't quite enough, we try two. Two, which is the marriage unit that exists in our present society, which seems to be having a hard sledding. Problem of two is that people get locked in power struggles. And there's nobody to arbitrate. And sometimes when those struggles get powerful enough, they can ride right through LSD sessions. Well, maybe the number three, but that's a very sexually risky number. So maybe four is the best unit to work with at first. Take two couples, because a couple is really the basic unit. Now, if I can understand why most of our experiments have ended, it's because we haven't had the courage, if you will, or the knowledge or the wisdom, to set up contracts for the communities in advance of a specific enough nature. It's too easy to get a group of groovy people and say, well, what do you say? Let's all live together and it'll be great and we'll all have sessions and we'll go places. Or just to open the door and in come 10 people and you close the door and there's your group. So there is some kind of contract because these kinds of groups often end up in somebody saying, well, look, that isn't what I'm here for. Right? So it's better to set it out in front. So in front, it is agreed that we are a group on a journey together. And that this journey, the goal of this journey, is to increase each of our awarenesses. And that we have decided to travel as a group. Now, if you want to travel as an individual, do so, but don't join a group. Right? This is a very specific type of group I'm talking about now, but it works, as far as I understand thus far. Make the definition of the goals as explicit as possible. It has got to be built into the contract that the person understands that the risk is his own identity as he knows himself. This leaves not open to him what is known as the cop-out of saying, oh, well, after all, that's me. That's the way I am. Okay? That's not available. The next thing is that for the first period of time after the group is formed, it can do little other than primarily deal with its own unfolding. And every participant must be ready for total confrontation at all times. That is, there is no place to hide. Can't get up cranky in the morning and say, leave me alone, I'm cranky. Can't go into the bathroom and close the door and say, well, I'll be in here and I'll think hateful thoughts while they're not around. It is a constant 24-hour commitment to being with the other members of this group. And the contract reads, I define, to the extent that I am capable, my basic reference group as the group rather than myself, the individual. Now, if you're not ready to enter into that group, then try another method. Now, the next point is that the contract must demand complete honesty at all times. And trust to the extent that you are able. Now, honesty and trust mean something different than to people that have been in psychedelic experiences or have been in frightening experiences with others than it does to other people. Very often you're going to have a session with somebody and you say, well, now, it's important that you trust me and that you be honest with me. And the person says, oh, I'm honest, I trust you, I trust you. And you start the session. And suddenly the person looks at you and you know from the look in his face that smoke is coming out of your nose. Your ears have gotten points on them. You're breathing fire. And you say, I bet I look pretty awful. Which is an understatement. And he's quivering from you. Because the level at which he said, I trust, wasn't nearly the depth of the level of trust that was demanded. Because suddenly he's thinking, what am I doing in this room with this idiot who's given me this drug? Am I out of my mind? Which he is, of course. And very often people have returned from psychedelic sessions. Well, the one thing I certainly learned was how much I didn't trust anybody. And that's why it was so hellish. I was asked recently, how do you account for bad sessions? And my answer was dishonesty. Because I am convinced that a person knows inside of himself just what's going on, and that I have very often gotten into a situation where gone through complicated arrangements to arrange a session, the person's there, and a tremendous cost and effort, but I know I'm not ready. And I have to have the guts to say I'm not ready. And being this honest, you can get confident that your sessions are positive and meaningful. Now, one of the keys that isn't in the contract, but it's a key to the community, is to keep everybody subject. Don't get into any of the hims and hers. It's not me and them, it's us. And when you experience a negative feeling towards somebody else, keep in mind that you have made them object to the extent that you put that feeling in. Next, the community should go as fast as the fastest person, not as fast as the slowest person. Because the person that's made the most progress can bring anybody else there very quickly. The group should always move in relation to the person that is most aware at any moment. Briefly, as far as environment is concerned, cut down on external stimuli. Desirable to get away from a high energy center, a city. Get away from all of the complex social vibrations that exist in present cities, if you have an option. No TV. Cut down on newspapers to once a week if you... That's enough news. It'll all be there. Put some control on your telephone. The telephone, as far as I understand it, is like dial a mind. Anytime you want to call somebody else's mind, you dial them, and when it rings, you're supposed to be available. Well, you've got to turn off a lot of the external stimuli for a while until the group starts to function as a unit. Turn on beauty in the environment, and this is what the women are great at, creating ecstasy in the environment with art, with flowers, with beautiful things that wake you up. Anything that's an alarm clock to wake you up to a higher level of consciousness. Meditative moments and a meditative place in the house, whether it's a meditation room or a separate meditation house, or in Mexico we had a meditation tower, or whether it's a nook in a wall that you go and look into, some place that isn't involved with the economics and the external games that the group is involved in. And as far, finally, as the role of sessions in all of this, I now understand the experiment we went through this winter. We got to the point where it was happening so fast for the four of us that we didn't have time to take LSD. All right? In other words, we all knew what the possibility was. We had all seen each other as all human beings. We had all experienced the unitive moment with one another. Now we realized, and we could see when it wasn't being realized, where the flaw was. There was sufficient consciousness for us to do something systematically to get ourselves to this other state of consciousness. So it may well be interesting that the moratorium that Tim Leary called for a year, which he said was a cooling off period, while I don't share that, I mean, I'm not making that call by any means, or even suggesting it, I do say that those of you that have had psychedelic experiences, many of you have come back from these experiences mildly depressed. And this depression, upon close analysis, is because you look and you see that you were involved in some very ugly human games. Social contracts with your marriage partner, in your job, a dishonesty here, a little deception there. A dead subject-object relationship. If you're a teacher, you're going in and looking at the students as them. Right? There's some point in your life that you see, and it's not how it could be. Now, I understand that the LSD experience, just taken once, starts this whole process. And what fascinates me is even the people who have taken LSD and have been backing out of the room from almost the moment they took it. Very nice session, very nice, thank you very much. Even these people, a year or two later, you know the funniest thing, right? Now, I can't... I can't really predict all of the things that will happen as far as the psychedelic world is concerned next. It does seem to me that for many, many thousands of people, a journey has been begun just like my journey. And if it is true that evolution involves increased consciousness, and if indeed I have labeled the journey correctly, perhaps the groundwork has already been laid down. And now all we need to do is listen to ourselves. I'm going to stop now and take questions if you have any.
May I ask two questions?
Well, I ask one question.
One question. Okay. Now, you've seen this, Baba's views on drugs.
Yes, I have.
That's not my one question.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Go ahead. This is a setup. I mean, I know I'm walking into this one, so I'm ready for it. Sorry. She's ready for it, too.
Okay, I'll try to talk louder. On February...
No, you're going to ask a question now. We're not going to make a phone.
I'm going to build up to it because this is one thing you haven't said, and I think it'd be interesting to the audience to know this fact. On February 4th, I believe it was, you said in Berkeley that you no longer anticipated using LSD in the foreseeable future. Now, if the paper is right, the Daily Californian, February 7th, I wonder, and you also said that you wanted to know what a man could... if a man could be a man, what a man could be without the drug. And you thought that the, it says the only way to achieve a perpetual state in which a man can be a man is through non-chemical means, he said.
I didn't say that.
Okay, it's a misquote.
Oh, that's from me?
This is from the...
check.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Now, you have... you have postulated that the... a psychedelic guru can be a safe guarantee of a good trip, of a spiritually enlightening trip. And I would ask you, in view of Baba's statement that only a person on the fifth plane, and we most of us are not even on the planes, let alone standing in any relation to the inner planes of consciousness, only a person on the fifth plane can safely, without harm to himself or harm to the person that he is supposedly helping, do any good whatsoever in
would
a
you,
spiritual
excuse
way.
Me, would you ask your question, please? So we can
I want to know what you think of this statement.
Okay.
Do you think you are helping people when you are being a psychedelic guru? Do you think that you are not harming your
One
own
question.
Spiritual
Thank you.
Progress?
Thank you, Paula. I'd like to tell you a brief story. One of the things one does as one works with psychedelic chemicals is one continually looks for maps and charts to help you understand more of what you're experiencing. Now, in the course of our searches, a number of us independently have come across the works of an Eastern mystic by the name of Meher Baba. And I found when I read his works, called Listen Humanity, God Speaks, so on, which are available from Sufism Reoriented on Sutter Street, I found that these were most in tune with my own psychedelic experiences. That his descriptions of other levels of consciousness fit in almost identically with my own experiences. And that he also apparently was referring to a lot of things which were experiences I had not shared. And so I used his books as manuals and sessions. And then, from an old graduate assistant of mine, I got a message that Meher Baba had met a young fellow in India who had said to him, you've got to stop taking drugs. And I said what most people say under these circumstances. Well, he told that young fellow, he didn't tell me. Then came the second message from India, which was telling the young fellow to tell everybody. So I was quite bothered by this, so I wrote this man a letter. Now, not meaning to say anything inappropriate, this man is an avatar who says, in effect, I am God in human form, and it's very difficult to write a letter to such a person. But I wrote as honest a letter as I could, and I explained to him what I was doing and how I was using the psychedelics. And he wrote back, or his secretary wrote back, one of the most sophisticated letters concerning drugs I had ever received, in which he said, in effect, the experiences you're having are illusory. They are no more like true transcendence than a mirage is like water. Then, he said, to a few serious spiritual seekers like yourself, LSD may have started you on something, but it can do you no more good. And what you must do now is follow me. Love me enough and I will take you through, because you need a perfect master to get to the seventh plane.